From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, we look at the year in tech and innovation. GE is settling into the Seaport District, and driverless cars hit Boston roads on Tuesday.
Obviously, anyone who's ever driven around Boston knows that it's a challenging environment with its unmarked roads, no signage, no lane painting sometimes.
And best-selling author and death investigator for Vermont's chief medical examiner, Archer Mayer.
Murder is just something that we do to each other all the time. Every day, there's going to be a headline somewhere with a murder in it.
Also today, the food trends of 2016.
So what we'll all be looking at is the pastrami, the corned beef. I love tongue. Tongue is among my favorite meats, and I grew up with it.
All that coming up on Radio Boston.
Every time I cook, look like you can't get enough.
First, the news.
Eat your pot of soup and make you drink it up, so keep on eating.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. All this week on Radio Boston, we're having conversations reflecting on 2016. We've talked with key thought leaders about politics, health and science, cybersecurity, books, and art. Later this hour, we'll take a look at the year in food. But we want to start with a look at the year in technology and innovation in Boston. With us in studio is Boston Globe columnist Scott Kersner. Scott, welcome back.
Thanks for having me in.
Let's start with something that's more of a look ahead to 2017. A Cambridge startup, Newtonomy Incorporated, will begin testing driverless cars in South Boston next Tuesday. Now, if you ask me, January doesn't seem like a good time to be testing cars in Boston. Not the
right.
Ideal place. You have the ice, the snow, the narrow roads, the one-way streets, not to mention the human drivers to contend with. Is Boston in some ways a good place or a difficult place? Which
I don't know.
It?
Maybe they're going to be programming these cars to figure out how to follow snow plows and salt trucks at a safe distance, you know, so you don't get that salt bouncing off your hood and your windshield. Boston is going to be a really challenging place, obviously, for self-driving cars. Anybody who's ever been a pedestrian or been behind the wheel in Boston knows that it's kind of a lawless terrain out there. The company you mentioned, Newtonomy, is an MIT spin-out. I've been talking to them for at least a year or 18 months, and they kind of have said, look, we're frustrated that we're a Cambridge company. We came out of MIT. There's another startup called Optimus Ride, kind of an ode to Transformers in their name, that's been eager to start testing. And they just had to go to other parts of the world. Newtonomy was testing in Singapore, where the government was kind of more getting behind and more encouraging of driverless car testing. But it feels like Boston now has said that in the Seaport District, in this area called the Marine Industrial Park, they've declared that safe for testing. It is an area, you know, we should point out, that doesn't have a lot of pedestrians. You don't often see a lot of bicyclists. It's kind of a industrial and kind of truck-centric neighborhood. So we'll see. I'm planning to go out next week at some point and see if I can see some of their cars roaming around.
Put them to the ultimate test. Put
right.
a pedestrian
like
in
a
their
jaywalk
way. Yeah.
In front of them. Yeah.
Can you explain, though, a little bit about how driverless cars work? Do they talk to each other, or how do they know what's in front of them or who has right of way?
Well, you know, I mean, they're trying to build all the intelligence into a car that we have once we earn a driver's license, using sensors and laser scanners to kind of quote unquote see the world around them and realize that, you know, yes, there's a mom with a baby stroller that's just started to cross the street and realize that you should stop safely, keeping a safe following distance from other vehicles. So, you know, they're trying to build this digital model of the world that we see in their computers and then follow all of the rules that drivers are supposed to follow. You start getting into some very interesting questions, right, of if you have to do something quick to avoid an accident, do you crash into another car, do you crash into a barrier, do you protect the life of the driver more than you protect the life of pedestrians or bicyclists around you? I mean, it's going to get very interesting ethically once these things start being sold.
Yeah, and bikes and pedestrians are very unpredictable entities on the road, as we know here in Boston.
Yeah, that's true. And so, can you ever have the ultimate rule set for these driverless cars. You know, companies are trying to develop them. I think the interesting point about driverless cars, not just is that they're a cool technology, but there is really a lot of belief that these can be safer. You can have fewer injuries and fewer fatalities if you deal with the fact that, man, there are a lot of sleepy drivers out there. There are a lot of distracted drivers out there. And maybe even there are a lot of bad drivers out there that, you know, if you could have cars be sort of more reliable, more predictable and safer in a consistent, you know, 24/7 kind of way, could we reduce traffic fatalities, which I think would be a good thing.
Now, Toyota, as I understand it, has set up a research institute in Cambridge. There have been some funky cars on the roads there. What's happening exactly?
Well, you know, Toyota said,
and you actually visited this research.
Yeah, someone tipped me off that they had seen a Lexus with all kinds of gear and sensors on the roof driving around Cambridge. So, of course, I had to go over and see it. I think it was a day in August. I just gotten back from my vacation, and I thought, well, maybe Toyota is starting to test self-driving cars. There wasn't yet regulation or approval in Cambridge or Boston to be doing this testing on the road. Toyota clarified after I had taken some pictures of the vehicle driving around the Kendall Square neighborhood, this wasn't a self-driving car. They're just trying to map and gather data and kind of, you know, collect information about the roads and pedestrians and signage in Boston, or the lack of signage in most cases in Boston, that they could use to develop new, more advanced safety features for Toyota vehicles. Toyota isn't talking as much as Google and some others about self-driving cars. They're just talking about kind of driver assist and advanced safety features. But the company said they were going to invest $1 billion in this new Toyota Research Institute. The two key places are, I think, Palo Alto, California, and Cambridge. And so they've been hiring a lot of robotics and artificial intelligence people for this lab in Cambridge. And it's run by a guy who used to be a MIT professor and then an Olin College professor. So his name is Gil Pratt. He has some pretty strong local ties.
So with Palo Alto and Cambridge becoming two key testing grounds, it leads me to wonder if Boston itself is becoming something of a new hub for car technology or car technology experimenting.
Well, we like to use the word hub a lot in Boston, right?
Don't
and
we?
So when
yes.
you have when you have two of any kind of company or three of any kind of company, all the boosters like to say it's a hub. I think, you know, look, the big three car makers in Detroit are still really determined to be players in self-driving and more advanced vehicles. So there's a lot of this activity in Michigan. There's a lot of activity in California. Boston really is playing catch up. I mean, it's great that we have two startups working in this sector. It's great that we have Toyota here. People are trying to take advantage of all of the computer science and, you know, advanced software talent that we have in Boston by putting locations like the Toyota Research Institute here. But I don't think we're yet a world leading center in autonomous vehicles.
But Boston is already a major biotech hub. There's that word again.
Yeah.
And Biogen has a new drug that looks promising for Alzheimer's disease. It's had good results, I understand, after two rounds of testing. And if it ends up being a successful treatment, that would obviously be a godsend to Alzheimer's sufferers. But what does it mean for Biogen and for the local biotech community?
Well, I mean, everybody's really optimistic about this drug that Biogen's been developing. There are, I think, about 47 million people around the world who have Alzheimer's disease. So that's a really big population of people who don't have a lot of good treatments, particularly in the early and mid stages of the disease, when you kind of are aware and you know what's happening and you've been diagnosed, and they basically say, well, you know, we don't really have much for you. There have been lots of Alzheimer's drugs that have flunked out of clinical trials and just haven't proved effective. And so there's a lot of hope that this is going to be an enormous success for Biogen if it can get approved. And they're still conducting, I think they're actually still enrolling patients in the third and final stage of the clinical trials before they apply to the Food and Drug Administration for approval. So we don't know that it, you know, that it's super effective with low side effects just yet in a large population of people. I think they've been looking at it in a population of about 100 people. The next phase is about 3,000, but it does seem like it reduces the decline in cognitive ability in people who've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, which, you know, would make this not just a great product for Biogen to be selling, but, you know, a great product for lots of people to be taking at some point.
Now let's turn to technology for homes. Countertop devices that take simple voice commands are becoming more popular. I understand you have an Amazon Echo. Can you explain what these devices do? How exactly do they work? And do we really need them?
No, definitely not. I mean, the biggest use in my house of the Amazon Echo, I think, is as sort of a hands-free kitchen timer or sort of or homework timer. You know, you can tell it, Alexa, set a timer for 10 minutes of you know, doing homework or practicing piano, and it kind of handles that countdown without you turning an old-fashioned, finding the old-fashioned egg timer or whatever. But it can also give you weather forecasts and sports scores, and it can answer questions about, you know, who was the 13th president of the United States and that sort of thing. It can play music. So it's not an essential device, but the Amazon Echo, and Google launched one in the fourth quarter this year called Google Home. There's a product, maybe we're going to talk about it. We can talk about it a little bit, called the Jibo countertop robot. So these aren't essential things, but I think it's companies trying to figure out, now that everybody owns smartphones, what is the next piece of hardware that we can sell them that will be kind of internet connected and maybe help you get information without clicking around through a million different apps.
Before we move on, can you address some of the privacy concerns with these type of devices? I mean, there have been baby monitors that have been hacked. So, you know, I can only imagine what you could do with something like Amazon Echo. And also there's the case in Arkansas where prosecutors are trying to get access to an Amazon Echo device. Essentially, a man was found dead in 31-year-old James Bates's hot tub. Authorities say that the Amazon Echo device can shed light on what happened that night. The defendant said he woke up and found his coworker dead, while authorities say there are signs of foul play. Again, the privacy concerns and the possible ramifications of having these devices in your home and sort of privy to everything that's going on
and,
in your home.
And storing snippets of what you say off in the cloud where you maybe don't know that it's being stored. The devices really are only listening for a few seconds after you say kind of a wake-up word. But I think, frankly, lots of people are not going to buy them because they worry about those privacy concerns and you know, maybe worry about these things being hacked and turning into a listening device, not, you know, not a sort of home concierge as they're marketed. And it's going to be really bad for Amazon if it's seen that, you know, you can subpoena recordings off, you know, from the cloud or from your Echo device in your house. And, you know, that's going to be very bad publicity for Amazon.
Now, on the local business scene, GE will continue its move to Boston in 2017. It's breaking ground on a new building that will be part of its headquarters in the Boston Seaport. How is GE starting to integrate itself into the Boston economy and the whole innovation ecosystem that's here?
Well, they are trying to make good on this promise. It was January 2016 that they announced that they were going to move their headquarters from Connecticut to Boston. And Jeff Immelt at one of the talks, GE CEO, one of the talks he gave in Boston said, you know, we used to look out our windows and see deer grazing around the hills of Connecticut. And now we want to see software developers and entrepreneurs outside our window. That's why we're going to Boston. And it does seem so far in 2016, they've been out and about in the community speaking at events, at the hospitals and at universities, and really trying to build these connections to our startup ecosystem, the digital healthcare startups that are growing in Boston, the clean tech and energy and sustainability companies. So it seems like they're trying to make good on that objective that they had in moving to Boston of plugging into the entrepreneurial mojo and the research mojo that we've got here and using it to shape GE's future.
A couple more questions here. You've written about the Trump effect on the local economy, the innovation economy. Tell us what the impact could be there.
Well, I think we don't know yet what the Trump effect is going to be, aside from, you know, during the campaign, he told a radio host that he thought the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, was terrible and was kind of a typical Washington, D.C. bureaucracy. And now this is a federal agency that provides billions and billion dollars of scientific funding, not just to hospitals in Longwood, but universities all over the Boston area that are trying to, you know, figure out how to cure diseases and treat diseases like Alzheimer's and others. So I think that is the big question as we head towards January 20th and head into the Trump administration is this federal funding of early stage research in search of new breakthroughs going to dry up, going to be reduced? Is it going to stay the same? We kind of don't know yet.
And now in 30 seconds, can you give us a big picture, medium term view, let's say, of what lies ahead in tech and innovation? Are there particular devices or developments that you're looking forward to or following?
I mean, there's a lot of interest in artificial intelligence. And I think, you know, again, with the Trump administration coming in January, it's going to be the question of, is artificial intelligence something that people want to invest in and potentially disrupt other jobs and disrupt other industries? Or is the focus going to be, how do we create more jobs, maybe at the expense of you know, efficiency and pushing technologies like artificial intelligence ahead? So it's going to be interesting.
Well, that's Scott Kirzner, columnist for the Boston Globe, wrapping up the year in tech with us. Scott, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Shira.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. There aren't many people like Archer Mayer. His resume includes travel writer, theater photographer, medical illustrator, newspaper editor, and currently, he's a death investigator for Vermont's chief medical examiner and a detective for his local sheriff's office. It's those last two jobs that have helped Mayer do what he's most famous for, write 27 crime novels featuring the likable but unusual detective Joe Gunther. His latest book featuring Gunther is Presumption of Guilt, and Archer Mayer joins us now from Vermont Public Radio to talk about it. Welcome, Archer.
Well, thank you very much, Shira. Nice to be on.
We'll get to your newest book in a second, but first, how does somebody with your background start writing a detective series?
Actually, you start upside down on your head, because I was writing this series of books before I began the other two jobs. That's one of the side benefits of living in Vermont, is that there are only 12 of us up here. So we all have to do everything, from the guy at the low end who lives under the bridge to the guy at the high end who happens to be the governor. So if you don't have three jobs in Vermont, you're underemployed. So I came here as a, I came here as an unemployed author, which is one of the prerequisites for the job, and immediately began to pick law enforcement brains, and they were more than delighted to share their tall tales. But I'm an ex-journalist and historian, and I love digging into people's brains and what they do for a living. I'm just sort of naturally nosy. And after a while, both the medical examiner's office and law enforcement said, you know, at this point, you probably know as much or more about what we're doing than we do. So here's a gun, here are the keys, and here's a microscope, and, you know, get to it. So they both hired me in various, you know, complicated ways. But there I am, and now I have my three jobs. So I'm a full-fledged Vermonter, even though I wasn't born here.
I'm a bit naturally nosy myself, so can you tell me what exactly does a death investigator do?
Yes. Well, of course, officially we're called medical examiners. It makes us sound like we read a lot of books. We don't. We find out what killed you. So if you're dead and you're 106 years old and you have a bottle of scotch in one hand and an empty carton of cigarettes in the other, people will stand around as you cross the threshold saying, well, I'm here to investigate why he died, and they'll say, duh. But when you roll him over and you find a knife in his back, you realize, oh, he had a cousin who was eager for some inheritance that no one knew about. This is Vermont, after all. We all dress down up here. And so that's why we exist. We, unless there's a doctor standing by saying, I said that he had triple trichinosis and it was going to knock him off, and now he's knocked off and I'll sign the death certificate. If we don't have a situation like that, then someone like me is called in to take a closer look at your curiously still body.
So I have to ask, what about that whole process do you find particularly satisfying?
Oh, all of it. I love being a death investigator. It is my happiest job. Oh, that came out.
That came out a bit odd.
Yes. a little odd. Okay. Well.
But right, I understand your passion and your intent.
Thank you. We'll put on the delete function on that.
No, we're live.
I know. Yeah, I know. It's unusual for me, but we are live. I love the job because it does two major things. It finds the truth, and it also delivers answers to those who are clustered around the guy who just died. After all, this is not a static situation. These people inhabited a part of the world, and that world was populated by people who want to know what happened. I exist in large part for them. Yes, I speak for the guy who can no longer speak for him or herself, but I also am there to help explain what happened and what will happen to Uncle Charlie or Aunt Maud. And I think that, at least in the 15 years or so that I've been doing this, I think I can see in their faces a great sense of reward there. So as long as they're happy to see me come across the threshold, which, believe it or not, many of them are, since I'm a local, area, I've actually had people look up and say, oh, thank God it's you. Because people know each other up here. And if I can help explain things as I just described, it brings them a little bit of peace.
I can actually see how that could be satisfying.
Yeah.
I have to ask, though, how does your work as a death investigator and a detective influence and inform the crime writing you do? I mean, do you draw, for lack of a better word here, inspiration from what you see? Explain that process to me.
Well, there's a bright, shining line that I hold myself to observe. Now, that shining line is never bring a real case to bear in a work of fiction, ever. It's not right. It's not honorable. It's not respectful. And I don't think that the people who have died or the people who have survived them need to be so assailed by the likes of me. However, I write and have written now for 30-odd years about people under stress. I don't actually write whodunits. I write whydunits. Why do we do what we do, and how do we respond to those emotions? And that's what I get to study as a detective and as a death investigator, is people in times of high emotional alert dealing with those emotions and trying to figure out how to do what to do next. And that I absolutely bring to my work.
Now, you've said before that your paternal side of the family comes from, quote, New England lunatic fringe.
Guilty as charged, yeah.
Okay. Explain what you mean by that, and how did they influence you?
Well, there are, if you were to take the New England historical anthropological pie, you would have, the Covington Wordsworth the Fourths, and they're the guys who own all the palatial estates on the islands off of Maine. And then you've got all the guys whose first names begin with Vito, who actually made all of New England tick by working in the factory towns and turned it into, unfortunately, what's now referred to as the Rust Belt, but once was the dynamo that made America strong. And those, of course, those are the guys that made us what we are, and we now choose to forget about them. But there they are. And then you have the aforementioned lunatic slice of that. It's a very narrow slice. And these are the scientists / artists. Most of them walk around in bare feet, and they're in a little bit of water off the shore, and they're looking at mollusks or seashells. And since this predates cameras, they draw them or they sketch them. And my forebears were marine biologists and or sculptors and painters and that kind, and writers. So I fit right in with that slightly loopy bunch. And we come from Gloucester, Mass., in fact, just a little bit north of you.
Oh, wow. So I have to ask, in a broader look at people, what do you think it is about detective novels and murder mysteries that's so appealing? I mean, it seems like everyone from young readers to old English professors to the rest of us, we've been loving them since at least Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes. What's the appeal?
I think it's chaos codified. In other words, we wake up and the world is a mess, and we walk befuddled through it for most of our daylight hours. And when we go to bed, it's still in a mess. And we survived, we hope. But we can't really sort of make rhyme or reason of it. And every day we read in our newspapers about the chaos continuum. So why would you read a book that mirrors this world? Well, because it doesn't actually mirror it. You've got the good guys, you got the bad guys, and you have resolution. By and large, you obviously get the sort of the countercultural ones that they're the dark books that in which all this is not rendered right. But for the most part, detective stories talk about morality. There's a sin, if you will, that was committed, and the righteous set out to set it straight. And in effect, at the end, for the most part, it is set straight. There may be losses, there may be sorrow along the way, but that resolution gives us comfort. And I think there's a subliminal message to it all that tells us that, yeah, it may hurt a little, but things will work out. And that's my personal belief as to why this form of literature is so popular.
Now, your latest novel features your recurring character, Detective Joe Gunther, and it's called Presumption of Guilt. Tell us a little bit about what that novel covers.
Well, I like the idea. I'm a historian by training. Before I wrote these books, I wrote history books. And I like the idea, whenever I can, of going back in time. So Vermont Yankee, which is a nuclear facility in the southeast corner of Vermont, which has now been decommissioned, was put in place in 1970, and it was a gigantic construction project. And it occurred to me that while you're slinging all that concrete around, why not throw somebody into it, you know, and then sort of pave him over? Well, come the decommissioning nowadays, 40 years later, let's find him again. And I love the idea not only of the science, what happens to a body after 40 years in concrete, because I'm a bit of a nerd along those lines, so I had to find all that out, and I have friends in weird places who can instruct me. But I also like the history, because the 1970s were a key period of time in Vermont's history. We always think of it now as the Socialist Republic of Bernie Sanders, but in fact, in the old days, it was the rock-ribbed Republican bastion, and that for hundreds of years, darn near. So wherefore that transition? Well, it happened exactly in the 1970s. So I can talk a little bit about that. But more importantly, and here goes to the heart of the novel, is that you find this guy. He can't speak for himself. And there you can see the medical examiner speaking. So, gee, why not dump some stuff on his head since he can't protect and defend himself? And therefore, the presumption of guilt is that if there are sins that we can link to 1970, and there he is, recumbent and voiceless, let's dump it all on him and make him the guilty guy. So I thought it'd be interesting if Joe Gunther looked into it and went, hang on, that's too convenient. I'll speak for him, and we will find the true miscreant.
So you mentioned a lot of science, a lot of history goes into your novels. Mm-hmm. How much research goes into your novels?
Quite a bit.
How long is that process?
I write a book a year, so you've got 12 months. In my case, it's 13 months just because I'm odd. So I would say I'd spend 5 months researching.
Wow.
It's not hard and fast, but I spend a lot of time talking to folks, interviewing people, going places. I'll describe the most unspeakable, gloomy, wet, damp, dark holes, and I only describe them because I go there.
So I have to ask, how much of Joe Gunther is you?
I should, of course, not answer that. but in fact, I'm as befuddled as anyone. There's another character in this series of books who is really quite inappropriate. I'm more him than Joe Gunther. I start every day looking in the mirror and thinking to myself, gosh, wouldn't I love to be Joe Gunther? And that may be why I describe him as I do. But it isn't 5 minutes into the day that I don't visit this other character whose name is Willie. So my day is populated with Willie moments, and my daughter, in fact, has been quoted as saying, "Doesn't anybody know you're truly Willie?"
Now, your 28th book is already written and will be out next fall. I can't tell you how impressed I am with the how productive you are. Can you give us a little bit of a preview?
Yes, actually, I can. It's a hefty book. It's coming in at 360 pages right now. And the reason for that is that I decided to visit upon my readers the fact that all cops know, and that is there's no such thing as a single cop or squad and a single case as we see on TV all the time. I'm semi-retired as a cop now, but when I was going full-fledged, I'd have, 20 to 30 cases going simultaneously. And it's okay. Everyone does that in law enforcement. Well, you can't write a novel along those lines. But in my case, where I have a squad of three separate investigators, why not have them have three separate investigations, all running parallel throughout this book? And most people, when they hear that description, they go, "Oh, isn't that great?" And then you'll tie them all together at the end. And I say, "No, I won't. They're separate." So tighten your seatbelts, because this is going to be an entertaining story.
It sounds it. That's Archer Mayer. He is the author of Presumption of Guilt, the latest in his series featuring Detective Joe Gunther. He's also the death investigator for Vermont's chief medical examiner and a detective for his local sheriff's office. Thank you, Archer.
It's been a real pleasure, Shira. Thank you.
Stay with us. In a minute, we'll talk about the food trends of 2016. And we want to hear from you. What trends have you seen and what are you hoping might disappear? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. We're closing out 2016 with a look back at the year in food, the top trends and innovations, and notable restaurants. From tinned fish to smoothie bowls to kombucha, there's been plenty to partake. And we'll look ahead to what we'll be eating in 2017. Listeners, we want to hear from you. What food trends did you love this year? What do you want to see go away? And also, what are you planning to serve at your New Year's parties this weekend? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Joining us now in studio is Corby Kummer, James Beard Award-winning food writer, senior editor at The Atlantic, and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. Corby, welcome back to Radio Boston.
So glad to be here.
First, let's talk food trends. What stood out most to you this year, and what had you coming back for seconds and thirds?
So, social consciousness was really taking off this year. Food waste had begun being kind of on the public's radar in a big way, actually exactly a year ago when there were tax breaks and various incentives put into the last-minute budget appropriation in the middle of December of last year to try to say we are going to take seriously the idea that we shouldn't be throwing out 35 to 40% of the food that's manufactured. Just this morning in my email, a food company said, "We process vegetables and for frozen food and for school lunches, but we now have a way of using trim," one of those industry terms, "and we've gone to zero food waste." I did a big piece this year for the New York Times Magazine about reducing sodium in frozen pizzas. And one of the things that Nestle, the manufacturer of like a million frozen pizza brands you never thought Nestle had anything to do with, said, "But, we have a lot to do with food waste now, and we have contests in our factories to eliminate food waste. The people who make Palm Wonderful, everybody is getting into food waste." And it's something that it just zoomed in public consciousness. This is something we should be concerned about.
And what about from the edible part side of things in terms of what you were eating, what you were seeing being served in restaurants or perhaps out of food trucks? What were some trends there?
So fermented everything. So, you know, we start with sriracha was the sauce that took America in, let's say, 2014 to 2015. Now you expect
it. I got caught up in that.
Where McElhenney's hot sauce used to be, and there's still Tabasco, there's sriracha. It's every place. So that is brewed and fermented. It's related to the ancient garum and fish sauce, which is fermented fish. So that's what makes for complex flavors. In order for big food companies like Nestle and Mars and everybody who makes savory foods to eliminate a lot of artificial food additives, they are making fermented foods because it adds complexity. So think vinegar, think soy sauce, but think barbecue sauce. It all has ferment in it. So when you said kombucha, everybody has a kombucha drink. It's just part of what's in the repertory now. Home pickles. Everybody has to have home pickles, including every restaurant.
Now, I'll say one of the trends I've been excited about is tinned fish. We actually have some tinned fish in the studio, some sardines, and some tuna in oil for everyone to sample. You can find it also at Salty Girl, which is Kathy Seidel's newest restaurant in Boston. And here she's talking about it with Chronicle on WCVB.
In my travels, I ran into a wonderful little stand-up bar in Barcelona where they were serving smoked fish in tins like I've never had in my life. The quality was so fresh. It was not what we conceived of as bumblebee or chicken of the sea, I can tell you that.
So have you embraced the tin fish trend? Well, I'm curious.
Yes, it's my secret vice.
It
is my standard weeknight dinner. So I teach right here at Boston University. I teach food writing. And when I get back from my 3 hours in class, I always open up a tin of sardines. And I order them. In fact, I wrote a long piece for The Atlantic about sardines and going fishing for them. I went on a big annual tuna fishing expedition with a group of foodies who just love it, and then they have the fresh tuna every night. But what I was much more concerned with was all the sardines being used for food for the tuna, because I wanted to eat the sardines. You know, the heck with the tuna. I wanted the sardines. So I love fresh sardines, and I love tinned sardines, and I order them by the case from Zingerman's in Ann Arbor. They are Portuguese quality, and I see that you have brought in one of our favorite brands at home, which is our Ortiz, and I have little oval tins of Ortiz tuna by the case in our house.
So feel free to dig in, but I have to ask, how do you serve them? Do you just eat them raw, or do you put them with, you know, tomatoes on a baguette? I mean, what's the Corby way of consuming?
I get a fresh Ancien baguette from Clear Flour Bread right near the studios here of WBUR. I only have my own hothouse grown tomatoes. I'm lying. I just take them right out of the tin with a fork. I do have
you
a fish
fork. You had me going
fork.
There. You had me going there.
Well, I mean, that's how I should do it. But in fact, no, I have it straight from the tin. They're so flavorful. They're so good. And it's like we're coming out of the closet as tinned fish lovers, because it hasn't been something you admitted to. When I wrote about sardines and my sardine love, which is a good 5 years ago in The Atlantic, my then boss, the editor, James Bennett, said, well, you know, I really love sardines, but I certainly would never bring them into the office. You're not allowed. And here you are, and you have them in the middle of the WBUR studio. You're very daring.
I am. Now let's talk a little bit about, as you chow down on the sardines, and there's some tuna there too.
Everyone has to buy the best quality they can of tinned sardines and tuna. Follow Shira Springer's rule.
Let's talk a little bit about food piled into bowls. You have the ubiquitous, it seems, grain bowls. It's pretty much what they sound like, bowls of any kind of grain, rice, farro, barley, quinoa, topped with a veggie, protein, and some dressing. You also have smoothie bowls, again, pretty much what they sound like. Extra thick smoothies in a bowl topped with nuts, fruit, maybe some shredded coconut. Are you a fan? Have you seen these all around? And does it have any staying power?
I'm very, very tired of what my revered colleague Jonathan Gold, the only Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant critic so far in Los Angeles, calls things in a bowl. So although I'm very tired of them, and I say that with my food critic, cynical, jaded eye shade, I have them all the time. It is so useful to be able to go into a sweet green or beefsteak at the near the Washington offices of the Atlantic and the Aspen Institute, where I also work. There are both Sweet Greens, which is a chain that started by four Georgetown grads, now been hugely successful. The second place they opened was right here in Boston. They have a number of locations right here. You customize your own salad. It comes in a bowl. You put your own grain in as a base. Jose Andres, the fantastic Washington chef, started a rival chain called Beefsteak. The difference is the vegetables are blanched first, so they're boiled, and then there's various sauces, including sriracha and hot sauces. They just don't have tinned sardines as a topping yet. They're useful. They're healthful. I wrote a piece this year for the New Republic about a meal delivery service that David Chang of Momofuku helped start as a founder, that delivers bowls straight to your workplace and has been hugely popular because they're made fresh right for you online. So the idea that they travel well on bicycles, they're stable, that's all very good. They just look dreary in their brown cardboard recyclable boxes.
We're reviewing the year in food here with Corby Kummer. He's the James Beard Award-winning food writer, senior editor at The Atlantic, and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. And listeners, we want to hear from you, too. What food trends did you love this year? What do you want to see go away? And also, what are you planning to serve at your New Year's party this weekend? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Are you noticing, let's switch to food trucks. Are you noticing any new trends with food trucks? I know they were big last year and the year before. They sort of had this big coming out party for themselves.
And I think they're going back in. As in, I think they're going back into the garages and opening bricks and mortar. They were like a testing lab for working out great ideas for small entrepreneurs, really low barriers to entry. It didn't cost that much to open one. The late Mayor Menino wanted to make Boston safe for them, and so he reserved a lot of parking spaces that you had to be very careful not to park in lest you get really expensive tickets. So life became better for them, and it became better for all of us because we could have inexpensive food of all different kinds. They're an exciting trend, but when you see the trend is that Clover and Maymay and others that made big local successes of themselves as food labs, as innovators, have gone into bricks and mortar locations. Maymay has opened an actual restaurant. Clover has numerous locations and closed its original truck. They're not gone yet, but I think that that kind of innovation will maybe go back indoors.
I have to ask, what trends do you hope will go away? And personally, I have to wonder, are we finally past kale? Are we over that? Is that done?
I had drinks last night with friends whose child has so much kale every day that she is permanently bloated. So just this very morning, I was going online for bloat relief from overconsumption of kale. So I think that there has to be new kale tummy relief and the way to get rid of it. And I had kale salad last night inadvertently from a very good takeout place. Everybody has to have a kale salad, and they have to have massaged kale. Yeah, I'd be glad to see a reduction of kale as long as there are dark leafy greens that substitute that are a little less challenging. I don't like the curly leafy kale that looks like parsley, for example. I like dinosaur kale, which is, you know, much more like bok choy or some kind of ordinary leafy veg.
We've got a couple of callers. Let's hear from Patrick, who is calling from Beacon Hill. Patrick?
Thank you for taking my call. Hi, I'm here.
Hi, tell us what your food thoughts are today.
So, you know, I love Sweet Greens as well, but, you know, I go there, I spend $15 for a salad, and, you know, I'm, you know, a young professional who lives in Boston, And it's, how can you afford to eat healthy? I mean, it's such a, I feel there's such a big socioeconomic problem with trying to eat healthy. And, you know, the food critic mentioned, you know, having fresh salad delivered to your office, but that's, how can you spend $15 a day on your salad?
Well, one of the things, that's always the question, how can it be constantly affordable? So Sweetgreen's has a starting price it used to of $7.99, and you can eat fairly well for $7.99. Once you add the steelhead trout, which is what I often do because I'm trying to emulate Shira's tinned fish obsession, it does add $3 to $5 to it. But the service I wrote about in the New Republic that delivered lunches was actually more affordable than going out and getting them, which is, say, $9. But how do you do it? You go and prepare stuff yourself, or you buy it in a salad bar in a supermarket. Bring it in.
And we have also Shane, who is calling from Waltham. I think Shane wants to talk about grilled cheese. What do you have to say, Shane?
This is just simple and quick. Why are we calling grilled cheeses paninis? They're different, right? I'm not wrong there. And they should be fun-loving. Where do they go? They're dying. What happened?
I think that people just fell over in dead faints from the amount of fat and cholesterol they were having at the same time. It's hard to get through an entire grilled cheese. They're wonderful. They should be called grilled cheese because it's a great American treat with loaf bread in a Pullman pan and buttered on both sides and put under a grill. They're very similar to panini, but they're with U.S.-style bread. So it's not that much of a sin to call them panini. But, yes, America first, grilled cheese.
We have John from Lowell calling, and he wants to talk about how he's going to cater his New Year's Eve party. John, what do you have planned?
Hey, I got great plans. Me and my girl decided we're going to have Subway catering our New Year's Eve party.
That sounds like a perfect solution to me. And we also have Courtney from Gloucester, who's recently moved from Southern California and is not too happy with the array of produce, I understand. Courtney?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I'm loving being back in New England. I can even deal with the weather, but the thing that has me looking back to the West Coast is the lack of reliable, fresh, organic produce that I'm so used to out there. I'm wondering if he knows of any sources from which to get this reliably throughout the year.
Well, sure. It's very hard to beat Whole Foods, and everybody loves to beat up on it, but for the produce, and every foodie's secret is Russo and Watertown. So if you have access to them, you go out. I love organic. I believe in it as a way of helping the environment and especially the health of the workers, but I will always go for a local supplier to find fresh produce, and you should go to the Boston Public Market at Haymarket if you haven't been yet, because there are at least 3 farm stands that sell interesting, good produce all year round.
We've got a very little bit of time and so much to get to with the year in food, but quickly, Corby, if you could talk about the 2 large marketplaces that opened this year, Eataly and Boston Public Market. First of all, Eataly, is it as big a deal as everybody's making it out to be? And if just 15 seconds on Eataly.
A very huge, fantastic deal of terrific imported and great locally produced foods. I'm really happy Eataly has opened.
And it was a big year for restaurant openings. If you had to pick a couple of your favorite openings, what would they be? I think I might know what one is again quickly.
Oh, well, if one is Bar Mezzana, which is the subject of my current review in Boston Magazine, and where I'm going tonight, which I can reveal because I've already reviewed it. I love their open face sandwiches, which they don't call panini, I don't think. Our caller is very against panini. but that's been one of my favorites. Any place that's, really small and local, I love. And you were thinking of?
Mamala's.
Oh, we love Mamalas. Mamalas for really locally made deli meats. And with the tragic passing of the Carnegie Deli just this week, served its last pastrami sandwich. Now we can get our own homemade pastrami, rye bread.
That's Corby Kummer, James Beard Award-winning food writer, senior editor at The Atlantic, and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine. Thank you again for joining us, and Happy New Year.
And happy eating for 2017.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.
How can our love go wrong if we start the new year?